The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Time magazine, dated June 22, 2026. The cover, as usual, is bordered in red with a narrow white border inside that. The cover is dominated by a photograph. The background is black. Time is in large block capital lettering in gray, and next to it it says 100. An additional caption says the 100 most influential people in sports. Again, this is deigned by Time magazine, not a local publication. So this is Time 100. The athlete of the century, according to Time, is LeBron James, and it's his photograph of his face in profile that dominates the cover of this issue. I think it's a black and white photo. Anyway, it's coming across as black in shades of grays, I think. It appears that he's wearing a black shirt with a brightly colored necklace or neck chain. LeBron James is definitely in profile. We're seeing the left side of his face. His hair is nearly shaven on his head, but he has some facial hair, including a mustache. We see the left ear. We see the left eye. He's not blinking. He's not smiling. He's looking straight ahead. Beginning with the brief, Culture Shock, by Philip Elliott. In taking on Senate hopeful James Talarico, that's T-A-L-A-R-I-C-O, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing it, the GOP reveals a midterm strategy. There's a young man in a suit, a white shirt, holding a microphone, standing in front of the Texas state flag. It's a gigantic flag behind him in red and white, white being the upper large horizontal stripe or block, red being the lower one, vertical at the end with a large blue block or stripe upon which is the Lone Star of Texas in white. Texas Republicans have nominated a Senate candidate with so... Oh, let me tell you who wrote this. Jeffrey Kluger. Who did write this? Philip Elliott. Excuse me. This is by Philip Elliott. Okay. Texas Republicans have nominated a Senate candidate with so many scandals to his name that an incumbent GOP senator said last month that calling him ethically challenged was like saying serial killer cannibal Jeffrey Dahmer had an eating disorder. The GOP counter? The Democratic nominee is actually worse, a vegan. As he claimed, the Republican nomination, May 26, State Attorney General Ken Paxton derided Democrat opponent James Talarico as Tofu Talarico and Low-T Talarico, implying his testosterone levels are low. A Fox News host recently called Talarico a gay vegan, and President Donald Trump's top advisor said Talarico is transgender. For the record, Talarico eats meat and has a girlfriend, but that is not stopping the line of attacks, which make clear the GOP hopes to make one of this year's marquee midterm races a referendum on what it means to be a man. The strategy is the most obvious example of something bigger going on in states like Georgia and New Hampshire, where Republicans hope to net seats. Efforts are underway to make key races more about the personal traits of younger Democratic candidates than about policy positions or relevant experiences. It is a sign that despite a year and a half of controlling every lever of the federal government, Republicans find themselves struggling to pitch a compelling narrative for continued dominance. The personal attack suggests they fear a debate on merits is one they will have a tough time winning. Nowhere is the effort more evident than in Texas, where culture war grievance has circled the sharp-witted but mild-mannered Talarico, whose campaign is a fundraising force. The competition to define him has almost nothing to do with the actual job of being a senator. Instead, it is rooted in Republicans' framing of Paxton's perceived masculinity and Talarico's perceived lack thereof, because he supported a local vegan business and likes vegetarian breakfast tacos. Even though no Democrat has won statewide in Texas in decades, Republicans, in making an appeal to the manosphere, have chosen a national playbook. The Joe Rogan crowd was a crucial voting block in Trump's reelection bid, and within an hour of capturing an upset of a nomination, beating incumbent Republican Senator John Cornyn, Paxton was doing his best to channel Trump's name. Whoops, name-calling bluster, six-gender Jimmy and James Talafrico both came from the podium as the state attorney general with a thick oppo file pivoted to general election mode. But it is a strategy that risks backfiring against a candidate like Talarico. Yes, he previously said God is non-binary, and that there are, in fact, six genders in terms of chromosomal combinations. He's also a white cisgender man who held his own last year on Rogan's podcast, so much so the host urged him to run for president. To be sure, Talarico, a seminarian and state lawmaker, has been walking back some of the comments that have been fodder for Paxton and others, saying his own past statements were cringy in hindsight. That light pivot has not stemmed the hurling of some truly ugly rhetoric. Fox News personality Jesse Waters tried to make a funny when describing Talarico as a gay vegan. Waters later said he was not being serious. Waters' co-host Greg Gutfeld also questioned whether Talarico was fabricating a girlfriend. "Does she live in Canada?" he quipped. "He's clearly transitioning into a female," White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller said. "When Talarico goes in for a blood test, when he gets a physical, blood does not come out. Soy milk comes out." Even the president has gotten in on the action. "He's a vegan in Texas, and you can't get elected as a vegan in Texas," Trump told reporters. Talarico, a steady and disciplined presence on the trail, is responding to the attacks while staying on message. "I've been eating barbecue since before Ken Paxton's first indictment," he said, pointing to Paxton's 2015 indictment on federal securities fraud charges. Talarico has started selling merchandise with the Talafrico branding, and just for good measure, his campaign confirmed the identity of Talarico's girlfriend after Texas outlet Current Revolt published her name despite the campaign's requests for her privacy. That is not to say Tallarico is campaigning on white papers. It is just that his critique of Paxton is one rooted in his opponent's real record, which includes felony securities fraud charges and being federally investigated, but never charged for public corruption. I have a legislative record. Ken Paxton has a criminal record, Tallarico says. Thus begins the next 6 months of competing appeals to the voters of Texas. Republicans say the Democrat is a cultural mismatch. Democrats say the Republican is corrupt to his core. It may be the most revealing race of the midterms. Again, that was the brief opening article by Philip Elliott. The Bulletin, an explosion sets back NASA's moon program. This is by Jeffrey Kluger. And there's a photograph here in this one-page article that's approximately a third of the page, maybe closer to half. It is a photograph of a new Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, rocket exploding during a test of its engines. In the foreground is probably the Banana River. It looks grayish in the light. This is a color photograph, and it appears to be running water, behind which there's either shrubs or trees, behind which in the background is a huge starburst of gold and silver and white and yellow. It looks like a huge, huge thunder cloud breaking open, but without the silver lightning. Instead, it has this golden tinge. Things got ugly at 9 p.m. EDT, May 28, at Launch Complex 36 on the grounds of the Cape Canaveral Space Force Station, when a new Glenn rocket, built by Jeff Bezos, owned Blue Origin Aerospace Company, ate itself in a massive fireball during a test of its seven powerful first-stage engines. The giant blast hurled flames, gas, and debris hundreds of feet in the air, utterly destroying the 322 rocket and partly destroying the launch complex itself. Losing the moon? The blast was a blow to Bezos and his company, but also a potential boon for rival rocket company SpaceX. It's NASA, however, that may be the biggest loser. There is no overstating how much NASA's Artemis moon exploration program depends on SpaceX and Blue Origin to help get astronauts to the moon by 2028. So far, neither company has covered itself in glory. This incident certainly throws a monkey wrench in the Artemis schedule, which was probably not achievable even before the explosion, says John Logsdon, professor emeritus at George Washington University and founder and longtime director of the school's Space Policy Institute. Shredding the schedule. In 2021, NASA tapped SpaceX to adapt the towering 150-foot upper stage of its 407-foot Starship rocket to serve as the program's lunar landing craft, a vehicle prosaically named the Human Landing System, HLS. The Starship program, however, is far behind schedule, with 12 launches of the rocket in the past 3 years, some successful, some not, none qualifying the giant machine as anywhere close to operational. The HLS upper stage has not yet been fully designed or built, but NASA expects a working model of the craft by the end of next year for a test in Earth orbit on the mission of Artemis III. Blue Origin has been developing an HLS of its own that's also supposed to fly on Artemis 3, with the HLS that performs the best getting tapped to land on the moon on Artemis 4. But Blue Origin relies on the New Glenn to launch its HLS, and with the rocket grounded until the cause of the accident can be determined and the launch pad heavily damaged by the explosion, the company's not going anywhere for a good while. More flights in question. Launching a crewed HLS, that's CREWED, is not the only job NASA counted on the New Glenn to perform. The company was scheduled to test a cargo version of the HLS in a lunar landing mission this year and launch a pair of New Glenns to carry rovers to the lunar surface for future astronauts. Those missions now may be in trouble. As the U.S. struggles, China is not standing idle. Beijing has promised to have astronauts on the moon by 2030, sparking a 21st century space race with the U.S. With the New Glenn explosion, America looks to be a good lap behind. The brief news on the next page. Good question. Do green card applicants really have to leave? By Rebecca Schneid, S-C-H-N-E-I-D. Under sweeping changes announced by the Trump administration, most people inside the U.S. who seek green cards will be required to leave the country to do so. The rule change dramatically complicates the process for hundreds of thousands of people who seek permanent residency from within the U.S. each year, and has sparked a backlash from immigration advocates. This policy allows our immigration system to function as the law instead of incentivizing loopholes. Zach Collar, a spokesman for the U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services, USCIS, said in a statement, I'll reread that. This policy allows our immigration system to function as the law intended instead of incentivizing loopholes. Green card seekers who are in the U.S. for personal or professional reasons and wish to stay on permanently have long been able to start that process without first returning to their countries of origin. In fact, Congress specifically allowed for applications from within the U.S. in Section 245 of the Immigration and Nationality Act. But USCIS announced in a memo issued May 21 that applicants should go through consulates abroad and that green cards would be issued for those within the U.S. only in extraordinary circumstances, and instructed immigration officers to make case-by-case determinations. Daniel Kanstrom, a professor at Boston College Law School and founder of the school's Immigration and Asylum Clinic, argues the likely purpose of the memo is to reduce the number of green cards approved. This administration is trying to make it as difficult as possible for as many people as possible to attain permanent resident status, he says. It is unclear how USCIS will determine how exceptions will be made, and the American Immigration Council has said the move is likely to face legal challenges. But at its broadest, the policy shift could affect more than 500,000 people each year who are living in the U.S. on temporary visas when they apply to have their immigration status changed to permanent resident. Now they could be forced to leave the country for months or even years while they wait for their applications to be processed, immigration experts say, even if they have jobs, families, and entire lives in the U.S. Half of all green cards go to people here in the U.S. who applied for a green card through adjustment of status. Aaron Reichland Melnick, a senior fellow at the American Immigration Council, said on Blue Sky in reaction to the change. This group covers everyone from spouses and children of U.S. citizens to skilled professionals getting a green card through an employer. Reichland Melnick said the new policy could force people to leave their jobs, homes, and families for weeks or months, all at their own expense, worsen the backlog in green card applications, and place those looking for legal residence at the mercy of consulates whose decisions are virtually unchallengeable. Because of the difficulty of applying for a green card from abroad, Canstrom says he expects most lawyers will advise clients to continue to apply for adjustment of status within the U.S. Even in cases in which green cards are granted abroad, someone could be stuck for years, he says, adding that in a marriage case, that could be quite a hardship. World Relief, a Christian humanitarian organization that provides immigration legal services, said that the policy is anti-family and will force apart husbands from wives and children from their parents. Business leaders have also expressed concern that the new policy could prevent them from recruiting skilled workers, since many apply for a green card after obtaining an H-1B visa. Those are among the work visas specifically designed for dual intent, meaning holders are meant to be able to apply for a green card without jeopardizing their current status. Andrew Ng, co-founder of online learning platform Coursera, said on X, "The policy will leave us with fewer doctors, teachers, and scientists and hurt American competitiveness in AI." After a backlash, caller, the USCIS spokesman released a new statement saying, "People who present applications that provide an economic benefit or otherwise are in the national interest will likely be able to continue on their current path, while others may be asked to apply abroad, depending on individualized circumstances." Here is the milestones page. There are two articles along with four items on the bottom edge, which I will read first. Testified. Former Attorney General Pam Bondi, May 29, in the House's Jeffrey Epstein probe, that she had delegated oversight of the release of the Epstein files to Todd Blanche, now acting AG. Rescheduled the White House Correspondents Association annual dinner to July 24, after a gunman opened fire while trying to force his way inside the venue during the original April 25 event. Died Marjane Satrapi, S-A-T-R-A-P-I, an exile whose best-selling graphic novel, Persepolis, recounted the rise of Iran's oppressive regime at 56, the French government announced June 4. So that would probably be Marjane Satrapi. Added, Israeli and Russian forces to a UN report recording sexual violence committed in conflicts, May 29, for the first time. Israeli and Russian officials denied the allegations. Now to the larger article. This is by Miranda Jeyaretnam. Jeyaretnam. Halted plans for slush fund by the Trump administration. The Justice Department dropped plans to create an anti-weaponization fund that critics feared would have gone to loyalists of President Donald Trump. June 2, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche testified the DOJ would not move forward with plans for the $1.776 billion fund, which was intended to compensate people who claim to have been targeted by the weaponization of President Joe Biden's government. Although Blanche has declined to put the cancellation into writing, it was the first time an official has publicly confirmed the DOJ would scrap the fund entirely after backlash from both Republicans and Democrats over concerns it would serve as a slush fund for Trump's allies and supporters, including those who participated in the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Legal experts also said the fund lacked a clear legal basis, with no judicial review or congressional oversight. The fund was part of a controversial settlement of Trump's $10 billion civil lawsuit against the Internal Revenue Service over the 2019 leak of his tax returns by a former contractor. The settlement was not made public until after the case was voluntarily dismissed May 18. A bipartisan group of 35 former federal judges filed a motion in late May asking a federal judge in Miami to reopen the case and review whether the fund was a product of collusion and is itself a fraud on the court. The judge announced an inquiry into the matter May 29. The same day, a judge in Virginia ordered a pause in the creation of the fund. Pushback against the fund from both Republicans and Democrats grew after Trump officials refused to rule out payments to January 6 rioters who assaulted police officers. And the final small column, Jeffrey Kluger wrote, discovered blue octopus, a mini critter. And there is a photo here. It's a small photo of the mini critter. The background is green, and the critter itself is a dark bluish-grayish purple. Let me see if I can count its little arms. Yep, there are eight. An estimated 91% of all ocean creatures have never been seen. That number got a little smaller with the discovery of a tiny blue octopus, small enough to fit in the palm of our hand, in the deep waters of the Galapagos. The octopus was first spotted in 2015. But it was not until 2022 that Janet Voigt, a curator of invertebrates at Chicago's Field Museum, got her hands on the preserved remains of the animal and imaged its innards with a CT scan machine. In a new journal paper, she describes the texture, color, and single tooth of the octopus and places it in the genus Microelidon. The significance of the find, says Voigt, it represents everything in the deep sea that we don't even know exists. And the brief news under the heading Faith, the AI tools transforming Muslim worship. This is by Andrew R. Chow and Juwayraya Wright. Tariq Qazi used to recite the Quran to his mother. Qazi is a 32-year-old Houston-based Muslim and teacher of Hifda, the Islamic practice of memorizing the Quran in order to deepen faith. The hours he spent with his mother studying the sacred text were among his most cherished. But in 2022, his mother died of stomach cancer. The following Ramadan, Qazi found himself without someone reliable to check his recitation during Taraweeh, the voluntary nighttime prayers performed during that month, for mistakes. So he turned to AI. Every year since, Qazi has recited the Quran to Tartil, an AI app trained on Islam's holy book. The app provides instant feedback and catches pronunciation mistakes. When I mess up, it actually does a good job of making sure this is the exact haraka, vowel sound, you missed, says Qazi. It has helped me personally because I don't have someone to recite to and prepare with anymore. Tartil, and that is spelled T-A-R-T-E-E-L, is now commonplace in many mosques across the world. During this year's Ramadan alone, it facilitated over 6 million hours of Quran engagement in over 180 countries, the company says. And the app is a prime example of how AI tools have become increasingly incorporated into Muslim religious practice. Imams use them to help write sermons. Students use them to memorize the Quran. Everyday practitioners turn to chatbots for religious or spiritual advice. If it is done correctly, it can really lead to people developing a better understanding of their faith, says Waleed Qaddous, a technologist and founder of the Muslim AI Ethics Organization, IASER. But the technology has also sparked concerns about AI's effects on the religion and its followers. It is very Western-focused. It is very individually-focused. It does not talk about community at all, Qaddous says, arguing that popular chatbots like ChatGPT and Claude tend to reflect the Western individualistic values of their builders. If we are not careful, AI will move us toward a more insular world where each of us is inside our own bubble. OpenAI's technical guidelines stipulate its models should provide proper cultural context. Sheikh Kashif Khan, an Islamic lecturer based in Maryland, worries AI systems designed for Islamic knowledge are being developed without sufficient involvement from qualified Islamic scholars. There's a very famous hadith narration of the Prophet Muhammad, he says, and the essence of the hadith is that toward the end of time, true scholarship will be taken away, and the only thing that will remain is ignorance, and ignorance will actually be taken as true knowledge. Some Muslims are choosing to renounce AI altogether. In January, Egyptian religious leaders issued a ban on using AI to interpret the Quran. But Muslim technologists believe the only way forward is to be part of the process, to improve mainstream AI tools while crafting their own. That adoption was on full display in February in Houston, where alerts from Tartil chimed through a packed mosque as the imam recited, identifying verses in real time for worshippers following along on their phones. A house of God smattered with people staring at their phones, trusting AI to speak to them, might feel sacrilegious, but Kazi, for one, believes tech can deepen devotion as long as users continue to center humanity in their faith. We should adapt with the technology, Kazi says, but if you really, really want to learn the Quran, then having the human element there will help you progress higher in that journey. Here's a photo spread, 2 pages in color. It's kind of rough here. The sky in the background is pale blue, and it is laden, actually, with white fluffy clouds. There's a team of workers in the foreground, 2, 4, 6, 7, I count, there may be more, and they're clothed in white, probably plastic robes, like the kind a hazmat worker might wear, with a full cap and a shoulder piece that extends from that cap so that the head and the neck are covered along with the body. Each of these workers is also wearing a mask, as one would wear during an epidemic, and each is wearing a pair of blue, probably latex gloves. Two of the workers are bending over to straighten a casket. It looks like a brown wood casket. There are ropes on it, so the casket is probably being lowered into the ground. There are green hills in the background. There's a huge pile of kind of tan, clay-colored dirt in the foreground. There are other people in the foreground, but not too close. The photograph is by Moses Sawasawa, AP. This page is called White Box, or in this case, 2 pages. And this is the caption, Ebola's Toll. Red Cross aid workers lower the coffin of a person who died of Ebola in Rwampara, Democratic Republic of Congo, May 23. The country's northeast is in the midst of one of its deadliest outbreaks of the virus. 344 cases had been confirmed as of June 3, including 60 that resulted in death. But health officials say many more have gone uncounted in an outbreak that apparently began in January and went unreported until mid-May. Turning the page to the brief health. At the top of the page, which is also in blue, BLANKET is spelled using the squares in a Scrabble game. The sleep trick that actually quiets a racing mind by Angela Haupt. When you cannot fall asleep because you are too stressed, counting sheep might not be enough. Instead, experts suggest a simple mental trick that can quiet even the busiest thoughts. The technique is called cognitive shuffling, and it is a mental exercise that gives your brain something neutral and mildly engaging to focus on so it can drift towards sleep instead of churning. Here's what to know and how to tell if it might work for you. How to do cognitive shuffling. Once you go to bed, pick a word that does not carry much meaning to you and is 5 to 12 letters long. The word should be emotionally neutral, so not something tied to stress or strong feelings, says Patricia B. Pedrera, a health psychologist and postdoctoral associate at Duke University Medical Center, who specializes in behavioral sleep medicine. We want to avoid words like money or deadline or anything that might trigger worry chains. Some of her favorites: blanket, garden, bedtime, kitchen. With your word in mind, work through it letter by letter, generating as many unrelated words as you can think of for each one. For example, if you chose bedtime, your shuffling might look like this: bee, butterfly, basket, bagel, e, envelope, Egypt, emerald. In practice, you would keep going till you ran out of ideas. This sounds stressful to me. The key is keeping them unrelated, Pedrera says. If your brain starts making connections or building a story, it defeats the purpose. Each time you name a new word, spend a few moments visualizing it. If you landed on the word goat for G, for example, you'd briefly visualize a goat, Pedrera says. Hold the image for a few seconds and then move on to the next letter. Ideally, you won't finish the whole word. You will have drifted off to dreamland. If you do make it to the end of your word, still wide awake, pick another word and start again. Why it works. When your brain is busy reliving or processing what happened during the day, those thoughts can keep you stuck in an alert, problem-solving mode. Your job is to change the channel and refocus on something that's more likely to help you fall asleep, says Nina Kaiser, a psychologist in San Francisco who teaches cognitive shuffling to kids and adults she treats. The technique also gives you something to do besides tossing and turning. It provides an alternative to lying in bed ruminating, Pedrera says. There's a neurological reason it works, too. Your waking brain is dominated by faster brain waves associated with focused, attentive thinking. As you fall asleep, those give way to slower, more meandering ones. It is a gentle shifting into a more loose, gentle, kind of random flowing state, says Sarah Gray, a psychologist and instructor at Harvard Medical School, who specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Cognitive shuffling helps your brain make that downshift. That is also why the technique tends to work better than counting sheep, Gray says. Counting is so monotonous that the mind quickly loses interest, leaving room for the day's stressors to come rushing back. Cognitive shuffling, by contrast, gives the brain just enough to do without revving it up. Who will benefit most? Cognitive shuffling works best for people who are having trouble falling asleep because of rumination and racing thoughts. I see this a lot in people who are otherwise healthy sleepers, but they bring stress to bed with them, Pedrera says. It is not a fix for everything that disrupts sleep. Cognitive shuffling will not address underlying sleep disorders, which need medical management. It also tends not to work as well for people who find visualization more alerting rather than relaxing, Pedrera says. If you don't drift off in the first few minutes, don't panic or start watching the clock. It's actually very normal to be awake and have a bit of an active brain for 10 to 15 minutes, Gray says. The trouble starts when people fixate on not falling asleep instantly because the worry itself keeps them up. That's exactly the window cognitive shuffling is built for. Something low-key to do while your brain settles instead of one more thing to stress about. In other words, choose your words well. Here's the page with 10 questions. This is by Belinda Luscombe today. Let me count them now. Okay, there are 10 on the page. And this is about Ellie Hollander, the CEO of Meals on Wheels America, on why local programs are closing and what she's going to do with a $70 million gift. And this is in the question-answer format. There's a picture of Ellie here. She looks like a middle-aged lady. It's a black-and-white photo, so I can't tell what color her hair is. It's in a medium tone, so it could be dark blonde to light brunette. She's wearing glasses. She's smiling. She's got on a dark-colored outfit, except her jacket is a lighter color. Again, I don't know what. And she's wearing a string of pearls. She's wearing glasses, too. Did I say that? Okay, first question. Why do you think volunteerism hasn't bounced back since the pandemic? Answer, I wish I knew. It is not for a lack of our program seeking help. Our seniors have had amazing lives. They're a lot of fun. I don't know if it's a time issue, inflation, the cost of fuel, or that all of these are adding to a financial strain. Question, is it fair to say Meals on Wheels is the least controversial charity in the U.S.? Answer, when we did our last public survey of voters, 9 out of 10 knew of Meals on Wheels, and of those, 9 out of 10 thought favorably of it. Question, does that reputation make it harder to get your concerns heard? Answer, we are a little hidden in plain sight. We got a boost in attention during the pandemic when all of us were having to isolate at home, wondering where our next meal was coming from. This is the reality that the adults that Meals on Wheels serves deals with on a day-to-day basis. Question, how worried are you about the number of local programs that are closing? Answer, some smaller programs have had to fold. Some are merging. We have a shortage of volunteers. Since I've been working here, I've been trying to get the charitable mileage reimbursement rate raised from where it was set in 1997, 14 cents. The business rate is 72.5 cents. But there's a lot of polarization right now. It is hard to get attention for really anything on Capitol Hill. Question, Meals on Wheels America is calling for $2.285 billion in funding for the Older Americans Act Nutrition Program in 2027, which is more than double current levels. Why so much? Answer, because it's never kept pace with need or the rising costs. Today we are serving about 2.6 million seniors. One in three programs reports waiting lists of, on average, 4 months. Some programs have 4,000 people on a waiting list. Question. Mackenzie Scott recently gave Meals on Wheels America $70 million. Even for her, that is a big gift. What are you going to use it for? Answer. The goal of Meals on Wheels America is to do what our individual programs cannot do. What they do best is help vulnerable seniors. What we do is advocate for them, raise public awareness and visibility, and do research to help make the case with donors in their communities. That is the thing about getting a gift like that. You could spend it down in an hour getting people off waiting lists, but are you going to solve the bigger problem? We are trying to do both. Question, we have Social Security and Medicare, and America has no food shortage. Why are seniors hungry? Answer, there are 14 million seniors who are threatened by hunger. And that's grown by about 3.1 million in just 3 years. They have limited mobility. They are dealing with multiple chronic conditions. They are not able to get to a food bank. They are not able to prepare their own food. Where are the families? Answer, the family may not live anywhere near them. We're often the first point of contact when something goes wrong. We are the people that reach out to a family member to let them know there's a problem. Question, is one of the challenges that it's hard to make this feel urgent? Answer, I think unless you have an older adult in your life, you think Meals on Wheels is always going to be there. Finally, question, to be clear, Meals on Wheels is always going to be there, right? Answer, well, Meals on Wheels is a network of individual community programs. Is there always going to be a Meals on Wheels program in your community? I cannot guarantee that. But will there always be Meals on Wheels somewhere? Yes, I absolutely believe it. Under the heading Society, and this may be abridged, The Japanese Cleanup by Bobby Ghosh. At World Cup matches going all the way back to their country's debut in France in 1998, Japanese supporters have stayed behind after the final whistle, pulled out blue plastic bags, and worked the rows, picking up cups, wrappers, and discarded flags until their section looked the way they found it. Viral videos mean tens of millions of people who could not name a Japanese player can describe the scene. The players have joined in after Japan's stunning 2-1 win over Germany at Khalifa International Stadium in 2022. FIFA tweeted out a photo of the Japanese dressing room, towels folded, water bottles lined up, floor swept. On the table sat 11 origami cranes, one for each player on the pitch, and a handwritten note reading, "Thank you," in Japanese and Arabic. Some folks cite the Japanese proverb, "Tatsu tori ato wo nigosazu." The departing bird does not leave the water muddy. To argue that this form of civility is a national trait. I'm not an expert in Japanese culture. What I can tell you is that the cleanup routine is one of the most efficient soft power campaigns of the 21st century, without a single yen of government spending or a single strategy memo from the Japanese Foreign Ministry. I will mention here that Ghosh, the author, G-H-O-S-H, is a commentator on geopolitics and a former Time editor. Back to the text. Can something as abstract as a civility be an instrument of soft power? Joseph Nye, the Harvard scholar who popularized the term, defined it precisely. The ability to influence others through attraction rather than coercion or payment. The Japanese tidying ritual is doing exactly that, and it's influencing others to follow suit. In Russia, in 2018, Senegalese fans at the Spartak Stadium in Moscow stayed behind after their team's 2-1 win over Poland and performed the Japanese cleanup. The Argentine sports network Thai C Sports posted the video, and it was viewed more than 4 million times. 4 years later in Qatar, the Moroccans joined in the ritual after their team's 2-0 upset of Belgium. They had done the same after the team's opening draw with Croatia. We grew up with the teaching that we should leave a place cleaner than when we arrived, Toshi Yoshizawa, a Japan fan, told the Associated Press after cleaning up in Wembley Stadium after an under-20 friendly with England. Japanese children sweep their own classrooms, mop their own hallways, serve their own lunches. The osoji, or cleaning time, is built into the school day, every day, from the age of 6. Until the smartphone era, this was a localized phenomenon, a factoid in a guidebook to Japan. But these days, civility, much like rudeness, can ride a stream of shares and retweets to the far corners of the world. If a president's threat to annihilate a civilization can instantaneously go global, so too can videos of fans on their hands and knees filling trash bags. Saad Abid, a Moroccan environmentalist and social media influencer, did not need to import osoji into his country's schools to organize a stadium cleanup in Doha. He needed only a phone, a stack of trash bags, and the example of others who had done it before him. Neither Senegal nor Morocco shares Japan's specific civic infrastructure. They share instead the willingness to watch what others do and decide to do it too. That article was slightly abbreviated because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138 to reach us here at the office and studios. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.